Thank you for joining in once again and listening to another episode of the Edible Valley Podcast. I'm chef and host Jonathan Fraser.
And I'm your co-host Aaron Howlett. Join us again as we go on another culinary adventure of the Comox Valley and beyond. Well, hello, welcome to episode 174 of the Edible Valley Podcast. I'm the producer, William Stringer.
I'm your co-host, Darren Howlett.
And I'm chef, Jonathan Fraser.
And today we're going to be talking about recipes, everything recipes. If you are interested in anything to do with the art of recipes, this is the show for you. We're going to be going through the history of recipes, the structure of how to write a recipe. It makes a big difference to the recipe. Even the purpose of them and how we're going to introduce recipes into our blog posts. So there's a lot to get through today in this podcast.
All right. Well, thanks, Will. This is great. Thanks, guys, for sitting down. And I think we actually got going on this is because Darren has been doing a little blog post for us with the Edible Valley. So I know a lot of you listen to us, but Darren's been doing on our WordPress site. So it's ediblevalley.wordpress.com. And he's been just doing a little blog about food he's been doing over the summer. And right. I know he was like, I'm like, oh, you're doing recipes. He's like, oh, no, these are anti-recipes. And I was like, well, I mean, like, you're really teaching people the structure of how to do things. You're just missing out maybe in, not ingredients, but like, you're missing out on quantities, which I don't think is necessarily has to be in a recipe, but it is definitely a part of technical recipe writing. But
I think that's the thing is that I think that I've started having written this cookbook and realized that it could be a series of cookbooks. And as I'm writing them, I'm looking and I said, you know, I would really like to take somebody that's never cooked before in their lives for, you know, maybe toast or boiled water, and how I could take them from on a journey from zero knowledge, zero experience, all the way up to being a fairly formidable. And I would think that by starting that, like the start there, the way to start that is to take the element of the chemistry out of it. Take out the fear of having to nail certain ingredients. If you remove that fear where it's just, you've got some of this and some of this and some of this, slap it all together and there you go, there's your dinner. You start there and then you generally, or I don't know, elevate into going into the minor chemistry of things. You know, like we start getting into sauces where, because by the time you get to like, say a bechamel, which is a pretty basic sauce, there's a chemical reaction there that you've got to nail. And
just had our whole listeners go, bechamel? What is a bechamel?
The blog so far and will continue to be a lead up to getting into basic cooking, I think. I think anybody of any ability can look at our blog with the recipes I put up and they're capable of doing them, whether you're really into being in the kitchen or if you're like, oh God, I'm being forced to do something in the kitchen. Where I'm trying to start the blog at. And maybe by 6 months later, it'll be a little more involved. I'll assume that you've got that shorthand.
Well, I like to, and we'll get more into the structure of a recipe, but I mean, I kind of like what you're doing because it's just, I like cooking without recipes. And maybe that's because I have 25 years of experience in a kitchen. I've spent a lot of time doing this. So I kind of have that. I have a little up on a lot of people. If I know, if I put, you know, 1% of this with 2% of this, I get a beautiful flavor. I still think a recipe is definitely a guideline. And I should say that very lightly because, like, it's a great guideline. And if you don't know what you're doing, like, stick to it as much as possible. But then there are your own personal likes. And, you know, this goes to the flavor wheel that we've talked about, right? You may like something a little sweeter or you may might like it a little hotter. Taking those and finding those ingredients that add that to your food can enhance it. That's why I like to keep it as a guideline.
Well, that brings us neatly onto the idea of what is the general purpose of writing a recipe. We've got the kind of two opposing points of view. John really likes to just, I guess you could say, for want of a better phrase, take it from the heart and just fly by the seat of your pants. Darren, you're thinking more, well, it's more of a scientific idea. So what would you say the purpose of writing a recipe is?
Well, yeah, in the basic sense, it's definitely recorded instruction of how you came to that recipe, how you came to that particular flavor, that particular reaction. The purpose of a recipe to me is more important if you get into the chemistry that's happening. If you get into baking, I find that there's a lot less room at first, at the top. There's a lot less room for the exploration as far as you need certain chemical reactions to happen. Baking is all about chemical reactions, harnessing chemical reactions. You have to follow those guidelines until you have those principles down, until you know what adding this much baking soda is going to do, or until you know what the activating yeast is going to, what the reaction is going to be there. You should be following a recipe. And I think that's generally the purpose of it, is a recipe in general is to be able to replicate certain actions or certain flavors.
And I like how you say that, because it's actually interesting, because if you go to a restaurant, to a bakery, big, large bakeries don't use recipes.
Right.
They use formulas. And they use a formula because it's a standardized a way of cooking, right? Yeah, baking is very precise. It's not something you can add a little bit more flour or add a little bit more baking soda, because you're going to get a completely different product. You're going to get a different texture depending on how much fat you put in. So extra butter or margarine or whatever, lard. No, I mean, you can use it in pies and stuff. That was my kind of thoughts on that, on those two, is that like a recipe for making a soup is much more different than a recipe for baking, which is more of a formula. And the thing is, you got to look at with a recipe for a soup is a great one, is that you get a butternut squash. Let's do butternut squash bisque. Sure. If you get it early in the season, it's not as sweet. The sugars haven't developed in the butternut. Whereas later on in the season, they've developed a bit more. There's more sugar in there. It's a lot sweeter. And then you'll get two different soups out of the same squash, depending on was it picked at the beginning of the season or at the end of the season. The same with if you get carrots that are come straight out of the ground, and you make a carrot ginger soup, it's going to be super sweet, really tasty. Whereas if you buy some carrots that have been tracked across North America, you know, and those carrots have been staying alive by eating on their own sugars within it, so you're losing a lot of that sweetness in the carrot.
So I just wanted to touch on the idea of a formula versus a recipe. I'm something of the layman in this conversation, so it's really interesting. So let's look at fish tacos as an example. Mm-hmm. If you're making fish tacos from a formula, can you explain, John, how that would work?
Well, and that's why I wouldn't use a formula for that, right? Because there's variables in there, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Like, how old is your fish? Where is your fish? What kind of fish are you using? Are you using something like a halibut, or are you using something like a snapper, which are two different fat contents within it, right? So like snapper's a little bit more fatty, whereas halibut's a lighter, more tender, flaky dish.
If in using your example, I would say the formula would come into the taco shell, the tortilla. There you would be more into, even though that's a really basic recipe, I agree with John on formula, but I think that sometimes you can even break it down further into ratios. You're like, if I have this much flour, I need this much salt, this much oil, this much water to make that tortilla. And all of that is variable. All of it is, but it's within a relationship of each other.
Like almost ratios.
Yeah.
Okay. That's brilliant, actually. Yeah. I really like you brought up the ratio thing, because I think that's a real key point to cooking. And it's a lot of, as in when I did my apprenticeship, first year was all about sticking to your recipes.
Right.
Second year was all about sticking to your ratios.
Oh, yeah.
So it was like 1:1 to 1.5.
Right.
And that's how you did a lot of your recipe writings, was on ratios.
Right.
So that's another great way to work. And it's a great, once you get to a point with a recipe, and it makes it a lot easier, because you can make a recipe bigger, make a recipe smaller.
Right. You can scale it however you want.
Scaling it. And that's probably something we should get into talking about.
So I just wanted to make sure we'd covered that. Are there any other purposes of a recipe? you know, we've got replication, I think you mentioned. Are there any other purposes for anyone to have a recipe? Maybe they want a legacy, maybe they're writing a blog post, they want to have something as their signature dish.
And yeah, I absolutely think that I mean, food in itself is a form of communication to me. So being able to take a snapshot, I mean, sort of not necessarily a literal snapshot, but being able to jot down everything that made that experience happen or that food combination happen and share that, that is a form of communicating with somebody. That it's almost a way of communicating like care, concern, compassion, whatever. I'm not going to, you know, jot down an evil recipe and pass that along. It's generally, it's a good feeling you're passing on to somebody else.
So it's almost the personal side of food. It's your blueprint for something that you're passing on that you hope someone else will pick up.
It also has value. If you think about it, a recipe is a value. If you look at, we'll throw out Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Sure.
With their spice and herb mix, a secret blend. Like, how many different establishments have their secret recipe that is only kept just to them? And most of those recipes you can Google online and find out what they are.
We have, my son and I made a KFC blend for whenever we make chicken at home. You know, I would say, I hadn't thought of it that way, but I would say you're right as far as recipes having value. Like, look at the economy of chefs behind the scenes in restaurants. They, you know, they create a menu, which is a summation of things that they've learned or they've, you know, honed, skills they've honed. And now you can build a restaurant around that.
Yeah.
Or when you're hiring or letting go a chef or what have you, or bringing somebody new onto your team, quite often it's what are your highlights? What are the things that you've done that I can, as a touchstone, where I can say, oh, yeah, you are skilled. Or, yeah, you do know food. I get it. You're not just...
There's a value to
there's,
that.
There absolutely
is. So quantifying it.
Yeah. And then it's not only talking about just the volumes of what's in there, but even the technique of the steps to get to. Because you can... Doing things in different steps, you get two different steps.
Absolutely.
We look at baking. There's really five or six basic ingredients in baking, depending on what you make. But you can have like different, you get completely different product every time, you know, like you have a fat, you have a liquid, you have flour, and you have a leavening agent, you know, and depending on how you combine those ingredients, you get different products every time.
Absolutely.
Right?
Density, you get one step that I used to always skip in my early baking that I didn't think had any merit was proofing. I was like, oh, whatever. This is a really warm room. I don't need to proof. And I was like, I didn't realize that I need those chemical reactions to occur, which happens over time, you know? And so again, that's me skipping parts of a recipe when I'm not educated and getting a horrible product. So like there is another, I think, another reason why you need a recipe or you need to follow recipes.
So that brings us quite neatly then onto a structure of a recipe.
Yeah.
So as the layman, when I write a recipe, there'll be absolutely no order to it. But I'm looking at you now, Darren, and I'm thinking there's definitely a way of doing it that can enhance the whole experience.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't even know about enhance. I would just say that, you're just going to end up with completely different results if you don't follow a recipe. Having said that, I'm highly encourage people to go off recipe as soon as they're comfortable, because that's where you start to develop your personality or your flavors, or that's where you can tailor things to have its own unique taste and things become more yours. But let's not understate the importance of making sure you know those steps first. You know, you need to have a shorthand, a vocabulary, a bit of a literacy there in food.
Are they, in that sense, a bit of a training wheel?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's a great way of looking at it. If you're not that confident, or even if you are, I mean, sometimes, I shouldn't say that it has to do with sort of a skill level. Like, I'm by no means an amazing chef. But I'm really confident in the kitchen. Yet there are times when I will not even go near something without a very good, well-proven recipe in front of me.
My reason for a recipe is I'm like, something is missing in here. Like, that's it's just going through that. I'm like, this tastes, this something's wrong. Like, what's the ingredient? And it's like going back to the recipe and being like, oh, I forgot to put, you know, chili spice in it. You know, that's as simple as that. I like the structure of a modern recipe now, because usually I like to look at about 11 different items within a structure of a modern menu. And this is probably what you're going to, when you go online and you Google recipe, these are the things you're going to want to look for, because they're going to help you out with a lot of information about what you're cooking and how you're getting to it. And I think the key thing is the name of the recipe. Right? Just what are you trying to cook? Like, and that's what it is. A next thing is yield.
Right. That's important.
It's very important, and it's overlooked, because, and it's the thing I hate the most about writing a recipe, is putting in a yield.
Can you define that, please?
Well, and that is how much this is going to produce, or how many people are you going to serve?
Right.
You know, with this amount of volume.
Interesting, that because whenever I look at a recipe and it says serves four, I'm not joking here, I say, well, that'll do well for me then, for one meal, maybe a small lunch tomorrow.
Well, that is, and that is true. And that's why I always like to be like, you know, like with a soup, is this going to make a liter, 2 liters, 10 liters? And the great thing about that is when you say, well, this is going to be enough for me, even though it serves four, well, then easily, if you have to serve four people, you just multiply it by four. And then that way you can go back to your ingredients and you just go times four. Whereas in the other point, if it's like make 16 liters of soup.
Yeah.
And you want to make half of that, then you divide it by two. And that'll give you your yields for how much you need for your recipes.
It's interesting because it always says serves four or serves six, but that doesn't really tell you anything because you don't know if it serves six.
Right.
What size people. It should say serves four normal people or two, I don't know, pigs. Like, and I would classify myself as a pig.
Well, and then it's looking at, like, and a lot of these things is another thing that's on menus, is nutritional value is something that's new on modern menus. So that's for a dietary need, as in you eat too much. But you work out a bit, right? So it balances out. Four, you can look at like the protein on the menu and be like, how much is that? Like if it's
extrapolate that
information. If it's a 6 ounce steak to compared to a 12 ounce steak, and you go, oh, there's four 12 ounce steaks that feeds four. Whereas if it's 4 2 ounce steaks, that's how much you're going to be eating, just a small little portion. So that can be a little bit of determining for yield too.
So that, yeah, that's all related to yield. Okay, so what other parts, what other structures are there?
Well, there's the most important part is the list of ingredients and the order to use it. This is where I get bad when I write recipes, is a good recipe, it should start from the first ingredient at the top to the last ingredient you need at the bottom. That's why all my recipes usually end off with S&P.
Yep.
Salt and pepper. And when I'm cooking, I mean, I'm using salt and pepper throughout the whole process.
Right.
At the end, there's that seasoning bit. So you have to know a little bit of those things. But yeah, that's why when you see a recipe that says onions are usually the first thing, because if you're cooking a sauce or soup, because you want to cook them first to like break them down, to get that translucent, to bring the sweetness out of it, because there's a bitterness within.
Yeah, it's pretty rare that you use a raw onion. You usually start like any recipe that's calling for onion, you're going to use with cooked onion. So, yeah.
And so next would be like the quantities. And that goes back to our yields. So taking those quantities, how much of this, how much of that, you know, the volume of what's going in there. And then here's always a helpful one, is how much time it takes to prepare the dish and then how much time it takes to cook it. Two different things, you know? Yeah. I always find, and these things are things you can do faster. Usually the prep time, I can usually do faster than what's written. And when I write a prep time, I usually give it an extra 5-10 minutes.
Right.
Just because, you know, you're fidgeting around. You're like, oh, where's the bowl for that? Where's the, if you don't have your mise en place, like, which is everything in its place, that will help out that, you know, that changes the time. But usually cook times are pretty close. It's a guideline, right? Like if you're cooking a steak medium or you're cooking a roast medium, depending on the size, depending on how hot your oven is, where it's placed in the oven, those can affect it. So that's why having a thermometer to double check that. But like, yeah, if it says 20 minutes, especially let's say chicken, You know, it usually takes 20, 25 minutes to cook a chicken straight off in the oven at 350. It may take 15 if the oven's really hot, and it may take 30 if the oven's a little cold, and you still need to check on that stuff.
Yeah, and I think that that's something that, that is key, is quite often we make a shorthand in the way we write things. We say, well, this is what it's going to take to get to desired result, because we don't want to fussy things up with, this is the desired result. Because then you're assuming that the person's going to know four or five different ways of getting there if the original doesn't happen. So to err on the safe side of caution, you're just like 350, 25 minutes, or whatever it is. It, like, that's that, rather than say you want an internal temperature of 145, or in the case of chicken, 165. But I think that that's the thing. Like, I like to write it to that way, to where it's like, okay, well, this is the desired result. This is how you're best going to get there, mm-hmm. but this is what your desired result is.
Yeah. Another thing is equipment. And I've done this before. Nothing worse than mixing up something and then realizing that you don't have your mixer with you. Mm. So, yeah, like before you start your recipe, just making sure you have all your ingredients available, or all your equipment available. So,
right.
Like, yeah, I have a frying pan. I have a sheet pan to put in the oven.
Right.
I have a wooden spoon. You know, that just makes life easier. Key one is cooking procedures.
Oh, yeah. That's a good thing.
Right? Like, mm-hmm. that's a key one. And this was the one that always frustrates me when I write it, just because I'm not the best writer.
So that would be Darren's wheelhouse.
That would be Darren's wheelhouse.
Oh, no. I've read a lot of your recipes, but I do know that sometimes you have assumptions that it's going to be you or someone of your caliber reading it. And yeah, quite often you'll leave things out. You just like, well, I used all of these things outlined in point A and now we're at point D. I'm like, what? What were those B and C steps? But
like,
yeah.
I kind of shorthand a lot of stuff. I like point form. I'm like, put in pan.
Yeah.
Add sauce.
Yeah. So that actually is quite interesting. So you're writing, John, for other people of your caliber in that respect.
Right.
But Darren, when you're writing things, you really are writing for people who might not.
I'm writing for you.
There's an assumption
that
they don't know anything about cooking. Do this and you'll get that result.
Yeah. And that's not to say that I think that nobody knows how to cook. I'm just saying I would really like to reach out and have a base audience of people that don't know how to cook. I would like to include them in the story or include them in the procedure, but I'm also writing to people of my skill level. I can't really write up.
Actually, I've proofread some of your recipes for you.
Yeah.
And that was one of the comments I made to him. I'm like, you missed
a
couple steps in there.
Yeah.
And it's like steps I would have missed writing down for sure, because I've always been a guy who writes them down on a cocktail napkin and hands them in.
Well, that's the thing.
If you ever talked to Sue Smith when she did the cooking classes at Beyond the Kitchen Door, I was notorious for, she's like, I need recipes for this cooking class. We have 15 people coming in and they want recipes. I'm like, okay. She's like, how do you make this? And I would write it on a napkin. I'd be like, with procedures, and she would dumb it down and rewrite it.
And I think that's the thing. It's like, I handed you 100 recipes and said, can you just make sure that these are structural, that they cover everything, that they make sense. Mm-hmm. And that's where you found, you found some of those. And versus when I've gone through cookbooks, you hand me a binder of 100 recipes of yours, but it's, you know, for you, it's not being written to that same audience I'm writing to. Yours is very short, but that's also because you know that you're writing for other cooks.
Yeah. And most of the time it's like, for all my recipe books at all the restaurants I've worked at, it's always like, most of the time it's sort of point form, you know?
Yeah.
I work for a time in Shea Piggy in Kingston, which is a great little restaurant. And I worked in the back of house, and my job was to go through this big binder, and I just did everything it said on there exactly in point form as it said, and it always had an amazing result. So much so that I stole the binder when I left.
But I mean, that's key. That's exactly right there. Like, that is, here's this restaurant's identity, and you want to be able to maintain that identity by having consistency. And the only way you can do that is to have everybody producing things the same way.
And there was no passion in there. There was no me putting my mark on anything. And I was more than okay with that, because that would have ruined the dish.
The other thing, and this is Will, because he's doing the most serving of any of us right now is serving procedures, how to present the dish.
Yeah.
Because that's a key component of it. It's to garnish it with, how to put it up, just some suggested things of going. Definitely on modern recipes, everyone's doing, and this is definitely in Darren's wheelhouse, but photos. giving interest, because that helps. I've always done recipes, and I've not done recipes, but I've always created a dish visually.
Mm-hmm.
Not as much. I always have a vision of what I'm making before I have
interesting
a taste of what I'm making. So I'm like, I want to bring this I want this color with this color with this color with this protein, and then I start working the flavors. So maybe that's interesting. I do it a little backwards.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't think I'm giving anything away, but you were workshopping a recipe yesterday, 2 days ago, for you were going to be doing a new lamb dish.
Oh, a lamb medallion. Yeah.
Yeah, and you were saying these are the elements that I've already decided on, because they fantastic elements that you already had together, and you're like, and you were just sort of soundboarding off me some ideas as to how to finish it. And like, I did find that interesting. You're like, I know it's going to be finished with red. And I was like, wow, I've never taken that approach. And then we started talking about how you could do that. And then you came to I'm going to take this and reduce it down. And there we go. There's my red finish that I know visually is going to give this striking appeal. And I was like, I've never approached a recipe writing that way. To me, I'm like, I want this flavor, this texture. Mm-hmm. How do I make that appealing? Like, what's the best visual way of doing that? So, but yeah, I think that that's great. I think I love the fact that we approach recipes a totally different way.
And then nutritional value, mm-hmm. which we talked about. And there's so many programs out there that you can plug in your numbers and it'll spit out how much.
That is a great feature nowadays.
Yeah, nowadays it's a lot easier. And then, of course, the latest thing, and this is basically when you're publishing online or writing a recipe, is people reviewing how good that recipe is. And I find I do a lot of, when I'm looking for a recipe online searching, is I usually pick about 4 recipes under the same ingredient or like the same title, and then read through them and then sort of match together what sounds best to me. Kind of like sometimes more ingredients means a nicer dish, whereas...
Yeah. I find it's funny because I look at old cookbooks, really old cookbooks, or like old family cookbooks, not even necessarily my family, and they didn't have pictures. You were completely reliant on whoever wrote notes mm-hmm. in there. Like, oh, this was great. You know, Henry loved it, or blah, 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 blah.
Or the big X through it. Yeah. Do not make this ever.
Yeah, I know. And it's so, it's a totally different set of criteria you're looking for to say, am I going to try this? Am I going to make this one?
So that leads us neatly onto the idea of the recipes going back in time. Now, has it always been this way, and the only change has been technological differences, or have things got more complicated as we've gone over the years?
Well, I think recipes have definitely got more complicated.
Absolutely.
I mean, going back to some of your oldest recipes out there, I think they really were off a ratio-based recipe, right? Like, if you even think about it, measuring cups, the metric system, the imperial system have only been around how many hundreds of years, you know?
Like,
we've changed our volumes of measuring, so which changes how we deal with recipes. So I think a lot of those original recipes go back to volumes and how we dealt with them.
I saw that you had made a small list of like oldest recorded recipes.
Yeah, I just Googled and I saw, and by no means this isn't a perfect list, but like some of the oldest recipes would be like beer. If you think about how we've been brewing beer for the last little while, which I think will be fun because I think we're going to talk to a brewmaster on one of our next episodes.
Oh, yeah.
If I heard correctly down the pipeline, that's something we can talk about there. But like, 3,400 years before Christ, or what is BC? Is that before Christ?
Are we
still
BC,
using that one? Anyways, like there's another one I saw. It was like nettle pudding.
Yeah. One of the oldest known recipes is nettle pudding. I've never even heard of it.
So it's something
that sounds like something you get in England now.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure it came from England.
Yeah.
With custard.
Yeah. The meat pie has been around since
1700 BC.
100 BC. Yeah. Roasted boar.
Yeah.
From the 4th and 5th century. One of the interesting ones was the Linzer Tort.
Yeah.
Right? Which is a classic European, I believe it's Austrian.
Yeah.
Dish, which 1653.
Right.
Is a standardized recipe.
Right.
You know, pastry and jam filling. And I know it's something that I know lots of people have it as a family, their family Linzer Tort recipe, but there's a standard recipe that's been around since 1653, which is...
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
Pretty crazy. And to think about how many other recipes around the world like that work like that. Like if you look at Japan, has a lot of their stocks and, for ramen and stuff like that, which have been boiling for hundreds of years. You know?
Thousands. The oldest master stock is 2,000 years old. So it's literally somebody made a stock 2,000 years ago, kept it on heat, and keep adding water to it as they go along. Whoa. And that same broth has been going for 2,000 years.
That's crazy. Unbelievable. I never heard of that.
Yeah. Wow. But yeah, to your point, when you said, have things changed? I think that sort of gamut or gauntlet of recipes John just gave you throughout the ages, going back 6,000 years to going back 400 years, 300 years. I think that, those probably all mark big changes. I think that the original was like, put these three ingredients and leave them be, and the result is beer. And then now you get up to things where, like the Linzer Tort, you know, you're getting chemical reactions that need specificity, that need, because you're baking, you're dressing it a certain way to get that very specific. So even though those recipes are old, they probably mark different achievements in recipe making. Now you look at where we are and the complexity of recipes. People nowadays are much more aware. Like you have Maillard reactions, and you have, as we said, proofing. You have all these different layers of elements in the recipe that need to be achieved. So yeah, food has gotten much more complex.
Well, and that's just cooking premises, right? We have fermenters. We have, well, that's an ancient process, but like there's new ways. A sous vide is an interesting one where you're controlling the temperature at what something's cooked at. And so you're lengthening the cook time to get a different result, or get the same result, I guess. Like if you're taking a steak that you want to have at medium and you're cooking it over a couple hours at that medium temperature,
right,
and not going above it. Whereas when you cook it on the grill, you're bringing it up to it and then slowing it down. Part of that resting process in meats. So
yeah.
It's just interesting that, we have new technologies. Microwaves. I was gifted about 50 microwave cookbooks from a woman who used to write recipes for the local newspaper, for the Record there. And when she retired, she's like, I don't need all these cookbooks. And somehow they ended up on me. So I had books and books about how to make microwave chicken in the microwave.
Interesting.
Yeah. Maybe not my best process of doing.
No.
The way I want to do process of cooking. But it's interesting just to see the cooking processes within there.
There is a very interesting little cafe in the southwest of England, in a little village called Beer, actually, spelt the same way.
Oh, interesting.
And you can tell that they've got this beachfront property, and so they get all the people because they're the only place on the beachfront that can be there. And so they don't have much competition in terms of people wanting the great view. You have to eat there. And they do everything like a cafe, but 100% microwave. To the point where it's actually a lot more difficult. So you go up to the counter and there's a bloke standing back there, and there's just this wall of microwaves. I'm not joking, there's about 10 of them.
Is he glowing?
He's just jumping up and just beep, 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 jumping up and down, moving, shutting this. He's like, it would just be simpler to have a frying pan, no?
Yeah.
And just dump a few sausages in there. It is hilarious. It's the point. There's a point at which using a microwave is a lot more difficult if you've got 10 of them.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
For sure. I've never seen that before. Anyway, sorry.
I know that microwaves get a bad rap, but I think the biggest thing that I find them incapable of is texture. I find that everything that comes out of a microwave has the same texture. And that's such an important part of a cooked dish is a desired texture.
Well, I think this is microwave cooking is something we'll have to revisit. Maybe I'll bring dust off those cookbooks and we'll do another podcast down. This will be how Will can perfect his microwave cooking.
With your excellent microwave as well, which is not at all falling to bits.
No, that's so good.
Right. So I did want to touch on our blog post, which is something that Darren does. He's incredibly dedicated day in, day out. He's taking a lot of time to write these amazing recipes and talking about them. So, thanks. Darren, yeah, absolutely. Darren, you know, how can this podcast tie in with your blog posts?
Well, I mean, I think you just tied it in. The fact is that the Edible Valley, you know, as the Edible Valley, as an equal measure or equal part of Edible Valley, found that I didn't really realize that we had a blog. I think that's even how I started it, or that we had the capacity, or that the infrastructure was already there. So I just thought this would be a great way to add to what we have of value. Again, that currency. This is something that we can offer everybody. It's easy enough for me to just take things that I'm normally doing anyways, and gives me a chance to learn photography in front of your eyes. You're watching me go from 0 to 0.01 at this point. But, you know, I encourage everybody to follow along as my skills improve. And in the meantime, I get to share food. But again, I'm looking at it from that prosperity sense of, I would love for 2 years from now, people to be able to say, oh, he started with something that anyone can do, and then just slowly developed, so that, you know, you follow Edible Valley, in a year or so, you're going to be a pretty good cook if you weren't already before. Like, that's my goal. So,
and it's totally free.
Absolutely free. Totally free. And that we're not even like hiding advertising or anything in there. I think I'll be completely honest.
Not on purpose.
I absolutely throw in some Amazon links at the bottom that do help us if you follow through. But there's absolutely no tie there. You're not obligated in any way. Here, you know, I'm like, here's the ingredients. If you're having a tough time finding them, you can grab some there.
Yeah, but, I'm just scrolling through one ear as Will slapped my wrist for that. If you heard that scratch on the thing, quit playing with your mouse on the table. Uh-huh. Anyways, just going through some of the photos and just how you break down. We're just doing your apple turnover. That apple turnover.
Yeah,
fruit turnover. I should get it right. And how many blog posts have you done so far?
Seven, eight. This particular recipe goes right back to something you were speaking about earlier. I say you're going to need some white sugar, and you're going to need that for the apples. And it says, I don't know how early or late in the year you got your apples. I don't know what type of apple you're using. I don't know how long it's been in your fridge. And that's going to affect how much sugar you need. Mm-hmm. So that's where you sort of get to that. We'll get to those things later, how you start being able to recognize and see where the needs are. But I can't just say you need a tablespoon of sugar because I don't know what apple you're using.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, anyways, as recipes go, I think that's the biggest thing is that, you know, learn to cook without techniques or with basic techniques and no recipes. And then we sort of develop how difficult it gets. And we'll get into techniques. I love techniques. I'm actually starting a YouTube channel that's pretty focused just on cooking techniques. But that's something else. That's a whole other episode. That's something else we can talk about later.
For sure. So I did have one question, which was put to you the other day, and I'm just putting you on the spot now to see if you know. So what's the difference between a turnover and a hand pie?
Danika, she, after reading this, asked me the difference. And a hand pie is made by multiple layers of, at least two layers of pastry, whereas a turnover literally is one piece turned over. So that's the difference between hand pies and turnovers.
You look so proud of yourself, Darren.
I almost think in some way you can call a turnover a hand pie.
Yes.
But I don't know if you can call a hand pie a turnover.
I agree.
That's the flipping of the dough over. So, all right. Well, good job on that one, Darren. And Thanks. Good job on these blog posts. I really enjoy these, actually. Even for my own self, I just... I mean, I love the mise en place of all your ingredients and the photos that go along with it. It makes it a little easier for people to grasp what they're doing.
Well, you may say with the photos that they're, you know, you're not an amazing food photographer, but I think that looks completely professional.
Thank you.
From my point of view. So I think for the 99th percentile of people, you want to see the best way the food could possibly look. That is definitely it.
Well, thank you.
Absolutely. Right, well, I think we've covered a lot of things recipe. We've talked about the history of recipes, the components of recipes, the reasons for a recipe, and most importantly, we've talked about our recipes on the blog post, which we'd love you to check out. So thank you very much for listening. My name is William Stringer. I'm the producer.
I'm Darren Howlett.
And I'm Chef Jonathan Fraser.
Have a great week.
And once again, thank you for supporting us and, more importantly, supporting the people that make up your food community. We're always looking for new stories to share and people to talk with. So don't forget to follow us at Facebook at the Edible Valley Podcast or Instagram at Edible Valley. Our website, ediblevalley.com, to tell us what you want to hear, or if you have any questions for us, email us at theediblevalley@gmail.com. And don't forget to follow us, because you never know where we'll be exploring next in the Edible Valley.
Good stuff.